I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop. It's a great pleasure to welcome back Chantal Mouffe to present her latest book, Towards a Green Democratic Revolution, recently published by Verso. She'll be in conversation tonight with James Schneider, political organiser and activist, co-founder of Momentum, and author of Our Block, also published by Verso.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and good evening to everybody, and sorry to be late, but that showed the difficulties of not having to use the neoliberal practice here, because the question is that Verso had booked a taxi for official taxi for 6 o'clock, you know, so a lot of time to be wrong. But of course, at 6:30, the taxi had not arrived. So in catastrophe, they made a book on Uber. Things that we always try to avoid because we are against neoliberal practices. The question is that, no, it's almost impossible to avoid that. You know, it's in case like in the same thing we had, for instance, with particularly during the pandemia. I'm against Amazon. I'm trying not to use Amazon, but of course, the adverse situation, it was almost impossible to survive. No, I mean, I think today is very difficult. We are so much, you know, in the middle of neoliberal practices that we impossible to absolutely avoid those. So, you know, it shows that the difficulties, and this is why I should have been here much earlier, but those taxes, you know, did not, but thanks God, we have Uber at the rescue, but you know, in principle, it's not something which I particularly favor, as you can imagine. Okay, so we are here to discuss with Jim and I about, not only my recent book, but also his recent book, Our Block, with there. In fact, those two books are political intervention in the present conjuncture. Of course, in my case, it was an intervention thinking, but not exclusively or even particularly from a British perspective. More from a European one. James, in fact, his book is much more centered on the question of situation here in Britain. But we are, in fact, dealing with a very similar problem. And in the solution that we propose are also, you know, we have lots of what we can call family resemblance between them. So we decided that, you know, we were going to really have a conversation about our books, so it's not going to be centered on my book. But of course, you know, there are lot of points in common in our type of intervention. But I will want to begin asking James, because I think this is something which for me is always very important, since something with their intervention in a specific conjuncture, no, both books. And I would like to know, James, what motivated you to write that book? You know, I feel that there was some kind of pressure to say it's time to have a voice and to say what we think. So can you explain to us what was your intention, what pushed you, you know, the impulse that pushed you to write the book?
Yeah, of course. Thanks very much. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I wrote that book against what felt like the overwhelming melancholy and defeatism across the left after we got smashed in 2019 and then lost the leadership of the Labour Party, and everything seemed quite grim. And, you know, I wanted to write against that miserabilism, in part because, as I think I write, despair is a betrayal. There's nothing useful that we can get out of that. But also, I think it's objectively not right. I think that there's too much beating ourselves up, or that the strategies that are commonly put forward. So I outlined three at the beginning of the book that have commonly been put forward. And to me, they are all defeated retreats to the status quo ante, how things were in 2015 before Corbyn got on the ballot and we sort of accidentally took over running the Labour Party. So it's trying to provide a very practical, optimistic but realistic plan for how, and yeah, as Chantal says, it's only focused on Britain, although I'm sure that there are some elements of it that could be applicable to other contexts. And the hope from it is that people will take it and then try to apply it to what's going on now. So what's going on now with the trying to bring together the cost of living crisis and the climate crisis into one line of activism efforts that we'll probably discuss more about, with trying to unite different workers on strike with climate direct action, with people not paying their bills, and mutual aid, all of which we're seeing much more of. And I think over the next few months especially, these things are going to reach something of a peak. So that was my motivation for writing. What was your motivation?
Well, my motivation was twofold. And in fact, the title of the book indicate that, you know, it's a Thomas, a Green Democratic Revolution, a subtitle, Left Populism and the Power of Affects. Well, I will say that probably the central question was, I wanted to show and argue that the strategy of left populism was still very, you know, pertinent for the situation today, because there's been a lot of talks by people saying, oh, left populism was a parenthesis. And of course, they say, look, for instance, Mélenchon in France, but that was, of course, just before his change of his better position. But they say Corbyn, Podemos in Spain, Syriza, all those have failed. They failed to arrive to power. So, I mean, this was a parenthesis, left populism. We should not go back to more traditional kind of left politics. Well, I was very much against that. I wanted to argue that this was still the best strategy for the left today, even in those new circumstances, because I acknowledge we are not anymore in the hot populist moment, the moment in which I wrote For a Left Populism. In a sense, you know, it's really a sequel, we could say, or a revisiting of For a Left Populism, the previous book, to the situation today. And so that, of course, there are things that need to be adapted. And in fact, we are going to speak about that, because it's everything that has got to do with the climate emergency. But, you know, the strategy in itself is still the strategy that is really necessary for the left. And another motivation, which of course is linked, but which is in fact all preoccupation of mine. I've been, you know, really writing so much about that at some point I was thinking, but I'm always saying the same things in the last 10 years, you know, and it's true. I think I've been obsessed with the role of affects in politics, what I used to call, you, well, I still call it, but passion. And by passion, of course, I want to insist that here I'm referring to a specific type of affects, what common affects, because, you know, not any type of affects are relevant for politics. Common affects, and common affects particularly who are at stake in the creation of collective identities. Because one of the points which I think is very important for me is that to understand that politics is necessarily something that implied mobilization of passion. Politics is a distinction between us and them. You know, I don't, of course, not everybody agree with that, but I think, and that's really something which is absolutely important and a strong point in the conception of left populism. Because often I was also asked, but why is it that, you know, look what has happened with left populism? They've been defeated or they are not going to go, but while right-wing populism is thriving. How do you explain that? And I will say, for me, and I'm really convinced of that, is because the left doesn't have an adequate conception of politics. The left believe that mobilizing passion, this is something that, no, we on the left don't do that. We only use this argument, you know, and mobilizing passion, that's what the right is doing in, you know, basically the fascist right. And also they believe that, you know, no, why should we have to distinguish between us and them? So often I'm asked, but why can't we just create an all-inclusive them, us? Why can't we just all be part of the us? And I'm saying, well, unfortunately, this does not work because this is not what politics is about. Politics is necessarily partisan. It's really the question of creating an us, but that implies determining an adversary. There is no politics without that. And again, you know, that's a question which I think, unfortunately, the right understands much better than the left. Because the left tend to have a very consensual conception of politics. You know, we should all agree. I think, for instance, and this is what I want to argue, that in the present circumstances of a climate emergency, a left populist strategy is very important because it is important to realize that people who are, you know, engaged in the struggle for what I will call an ecological bifurcation, and I think here we are James, we certainly agree on that. But for instance, among the ecological movement, I think that there are too many people who see that in a consensual way. I mean, and many ecological parties, I find, they don't want to construct an adversary. They believe that, well, this is a question that we should all agree on that because it concerns us all. Well, unfortunately, I think they are. There will always be people who are going to oppose the measures which are necessary for an ecological bifurcation. And it's important for the also, for instance, the activists on the climate emergency to realize that. They are, the fossil fuel industries are not going to disappear like that. They are to accept, oh yeah, no, that's not good. No, they will have to be fought. And again, I think that's a question which left populism really put in you know, on the forefront. Politics for the left populist strategy is the construction of an adversary, what we call the determination of a frontier. And also another element, which I think is very important, is the question of putting into question the rationalist conception of politics, which is dominant in the left. And that's something that you don't find in the right. So my book is precisely about that. You know, first reassert the importance of the left populist strategy, precisely because it's a different conception of politics, which is much more adequate than the one which is usually found in many left movements or left parties. And also to insist that, of course, with this left populist strategy need to be always adapted to the conjuncture. You know, and this is why, for instance, I think that no, this left populist strategy should be envisaged as the fight for a green democratic revolution. This is something, for instance, that I was not so much putting, you know, the accent in for left populism, even if there, I mean, there is a chapter which I insist that this is something which is very important today, that we cannot really imagine a left strategy that does not include precisely, you know, the end of a productivist and extractivist model. But I was not really putting that as the what we call, with Ernesto Laclau and myself, an hegemonic signifier, you know, the kind of signifier which is going to unite all the different parts of the left. We thought, yeah, it's demand, ecological demand are, in fact, important, for even since hegemonic socialist strategy in 1985. We were already indicating, yeah, but it was a demand among other demands. Now I think that this is, we've become aware of the fact that there is an incredible urgency. About that. It's not just one demand among the other. This must be the one, you know, which is really going to crystallize the view of that left movement should be fighting for. So the book is about that, you know, the critique of the rationalist conception of politics, which is a question that I've been dealing with for a long time. But how should we envisage that in terms of the present conjuncture? So I think that from a point of view, maybe, well, don't know what you will want to ask me about that, but maybe we should examine what is the specificity of this present conjuncture. What do you think?
Yeah, what do you think are the main things that have changed in the last... I mean, it feels like everything has changed in the last 3 years. Between your two last books, this being an update on For a Left Populism, what are the key elements, do you think, that have changed
I think that the main question is precisely the central role that the you know, ecological question and should play today. I think because in fact what we were already saying in that book and already in fact in hegemony socialist strategy, you know, because if you see the question of populism, for instance, the term does not appear at all in hegemony socialist strategy. But the idea is there because what we are saying, the book was to say the left cannot center its demands only around the question of the class struggle. And I say only because we've been accused of abandoning the class struggle. You know, we never say that. What we are saying is that workers' demands are very important, but they are also the demand of the feminists and the anti-racists, and as I was saying, also be always in the ecological question. But I think that, well, this is still valid today, of course, but no, there are many more demands that need to be articulated. So, in fact, the idea was that the emancipatory subject or revolutionary subject, as you want to call it, this need to be an articulation, what we call a chain of equivalence, between a series of democratic demands. And I think that still, of course, today, what is central for a left struggle. But I think that, and that will be the difference I see today, the centrality, that all those demands need to be articulated around the question of, you know, the ecological bifurcation. For instance, it's absolutely central today to articulate social demand, all the demands which are, let's say, socioeconomic, and then all the demands what are called the new social movement, which the moment we brought hegemony. But today, the ecological question. So it's still, you know, even if the need to articulate ecological demand was present before, I think that today it is really, it must play a very important role. That's what I will say, the different. But I will also say there is something different, which, and that is why I think the question of the conjuncture is important. Because, well, there remember the moment of the pandemic, well, the what was before envisaged as the populist moment, you know. The populist moment was something which was clearly indicating, well, it was the consequence, of course, of the 2008 crisis, and it was indicating the need to, can I put it, well, not the need, that's wrong to say it like that, but it was indicating the crisis of the hegemony of neoliberalism. Yeah? I think I will insist on the hegemony because not necessarily a crisis of the practice of neoliberalism, but the fact that the hegemony, it was not before, up to the 2008, I would say, there was some kind of uncontested hegemony of neoliberalism, which began to break down in a moment of the crisis. And in fact, all the movements that appeared in the 2010 were all, and in different countries we've seen that, were all indication that the hegemony of neoliberalism had been, you know, put into question. And at that moment, I think we were quite a few to think that this was the end, the beginning of the end of neoliberalism. Well, today I must say that I'm not so optimistic, because what I am seeing, and here I disagree with some position in the left who are claiming that we are now, because of everything that happened around the crisis, in a post-neoliberal era. You know, not necessarily something much better, but post-neoliberal. I believe, and this is something I also argue in the book, that in fact what we are seeing is more the a new form of neoliberalism. But in fact, neoliberalism is maintained, trying to gain a new lease of life, to develop under a new form, a form which is very authoritarian. You know, I think that we are really moving toward what men call an authoritarian neoliberalism. So, and that's what I'm really worried about, is that this authoritarian form is being legitimized because of people are told that, well, you know, all those measures are absolutely necessary in order to protect people. And here is the question of the affects is important. And I think that for the left is very important to understand that, because one of the consequences of the pandemic has been the development of a sense of fragility, vulnerability among people, you know? And of course, no, it's obviously reinforced with the war in Ukraine, and so there is a general feeling of vulnerability and a demand for protection. I think that is very important for the left to understand this demand for protection, because there is in the left some tendency to say, oh, but that's conservative demand for protection, you know, and not to really give too much importance to that. I think that the left must address this demand for protection, because this demand for protection is already addressed by the right in different ways, by the extreme right and by the, you know, kind of center-left right, if one can put it like that. And in fact, this kind of authoritarian neoliberalism is a way in which they are trying to address that authoritarian measure. The development of digital capitalism are presented as form in which, you know, we are now protected by the state. And I think, for instance, I'm very struck by the fact that today many people are accepting form of control that they would never have accepted 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, because they say, well, you know, that's what we need in order to have protection. So I think it's very, and this is for me the basis of this new form of neoliberalism, the way in which it is trying to regain legitimacy. And I think that today we are at a moment where it's very important for the left to address this demand for protection, but of course in a way which is going to further democratic advances. Because protection does not necessarily lead to conservatism. You know, protection can also be some kind of protection which is going to new rights, new form of participation. I think protection can be really oriented towards regressive measure or progressive measure. And this is, for me, what is really new in the conjuncture. That was not the case at the moment when I wrote for left populism. At that moment, I think we were much more confident in the fact that, you know, there was a crisis of neoliberalism. And I think today that, well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not too terribly optimistic in the fact that we are going to have necessarily, as a consequence of the crisis, more progressive movement. It's all a question of acting that. And they are, of course, and this is something which James showed very clearly in his book, there are many different forms of resistance. You know, but those forms of resistance need to be articulated, need to be creating, as they call it, a block. You know, so I think this is why I see the relation between the new form of, the new type of demands, you know, and the way in which there is a need to articulate all those different movements, because the things are there. But in order to really produce a popular movement, they need to be articulated. And I think that's, you know, also it seems to me one of the important points that James is making in his book, the need to articulate those movements. Will you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, I'm maybe slightly more optimistic, although I've got the same basic understanding, because I think, you know, we're in the same crisis from 2008, it's just in a deeper level, and there's no coming out of it. So the ruling class might try, as it is trying, with authoritarian neoliberalism, but that's got no capacity to set off a new cycle of capital accumulation. It's got no capacity to buy off enough of the population, I think, to bring back boring, normal stability that they would like to see. Because I think, you know, everything is bad, it's about to get worse, and everybody knows that. And, you know, that's the ground on which we're operating as progressives trying to bring about progressive change. And that's also the ground that the ruling class has to deal with. The neoliberal hegemony is really very fractured. They try to piece it back together, but it's really very, very fractured. So, look at, you know, specifically in the UK, that there's a kind of latent progressive common sense, social democratic common sense on a huge range of issues, particularly social economic, but also environmental, that are quite a long way to the left, or at least a bit to the left, of where we ended up in 2019. So if you look at questions of wealth tax, taxing the rich, public ownership, minimum wage, they are all, you know, big, big super majorities in favour of progressive solutions. Majority of people on the right, majority of people who vote Tory, want public ownership of energy, for example, as a response to the crisis. The majority of Tory voters want a wealth tax. So there is this base. Then who can engage with public opinion? Well, we're not leading with a party. That's we're in the hot moment of left populism. There were these different figures or parties that were pushing forward in that manner. We don't have that, but our movements are stronger, I think, than they were 7 years ago. So take the trade union movement, for example, which is, you know, Britain's biggest social movement by miles, admittedly from a really low base. But for the 4 years, 2016 to 2020, trade union membership rose every single year, which is the first time it's done that for 45 years. We're seeing strike levels are still at historically very low base, but as we're seeing now and as we're seeing going into the winter, you know, much larger. Perhaps anecdotally, but you mentioned Amazon, Chantal. I organised the Make Amazon Pay Coalition, which is a global coalition of trade unions, environmentalists, civil society groups, tax justice groups to take on Amazon around the world. And we organised a global day of action in 25, 30 countries with strikes and protests simultaneously on Black Friday, which is the 25th of November. Now, last year, basically, we're the only small L labour story going, and that you know, on the day and around that, and likewise in the previous year. In the UK, you know, already going on strike on that day will be every single university on strike on the 25th of November. 150,000 postal workers, and then there will be some Amazon workers and supply chains and so on. So the temperature of that struggle is hotting up. And then we've seen over the last few years how new social movements like Black Lives Matter or Extinction Rebellion or their, you know, ancillary associated movements and organisations can really capture public imagination and can shift attitudes on issues and can mobilise and organise for things. So we've got, I think, a lot of conditions that could lead to another big surge, that could lead to the potential for a progressive advance. But the thing that we don't have is there's no party that is leading that. So I think that's why a lot of the strategic debate on the British left seems to boil down to Labour Party, yes or no. And I'm sure at least two-thirds of the questions that get put to me this evening, if they do get put to me, will just be asking me that question, even though I'm about to say my answer now. And and it will be the thing that most people will come up to talk about afterwards, because that's the thing that people are motivated about. But I think it is the wrong question. I think it is putting the cart before the horse for two reasons. One is more theoretical strategic, which is we had the leadership of the Labour Party and we didn't lose because we had the leadership of the Labour Party. We lost because we had, I mean, a variety of mistakes made and lots of other contingent factors as well, and Brexit and so on and so forth. But the set of progressive social forces in the country were weak relative to the strength of the ruling bloc, even though that theirs was fractured and had weaknesses. So it seems to me talking about the party rather than the forces that we need to develop is putting the cart before the horse. And then I think it's a mistake for practical reasons. It would be a distraction. Because if your answer to that question is, yes, the Labour Party is the only conceivable vehicle and it's incredibly important, more important than anything else, therefore, that we get back control of it, everyone would spend all of their time doing Labour-left things and spend no time doing industrial, social, ecological, anti-racist, feminist and so on types of organising, which are absolutely vital. Or you'd say, no, the Labour Party belongs in the bin, we need to create a new party. And so then everyone would spend their time setting up a new, you know, small organisation that wouldn't have a basis in social movements, in trade unions and so on, and setting up an organisation, its rules, its constitution, its procedures is extremely time consuming and it's not a mass activity, generally speaking. It's not something that brings people in that are new to political activism, which the other types of organising we're talking about, which going on strike, that introduces politics to some people that won't have had it before. Likewise, environmental campaigns, feminist campaigns, and so on. So that's why I argue in the book for a left bloc. So that's trying to bring together in coordination and in some form of formal alliance, recognising that anything is going to be piecemeal and bit by bit, the resources that I think we have. So that's the left-led trade unions and the left in other trade unions. It's the social movements we're talking about, disabled people against cuts, Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, Black Lives Matter, and so on. and it is and it's the remaining left that is in the Labour Party, which still has, you know, maybe 150,000 left-wing people in its membership, maybe a little bit more, and some MPs, some councils, and so on, and try to bring those together so they can coordinate and act in a way that is consistent with, I think, what Chantal is laying out, and with left populism, although in the book I call it this form movement populism to connote that it will more be movements that are in the lead in constructing the line of antagonism and in driving forward our politics than any sort of single political leadership, because, you know, because we don't have that. So, yeah, and maybe I'll say one more thing about what that means practically. Mm. So what that would mean in practice, I think now, so rather than thinking that we can get to exactly where magic the party that we want to exist out of thin air, which we can't do, we can strengthen all the forms of resistance that are currently taking place, which are growing and are really inspiring. And they're the four types of resistance that we've seen, you know, basically at every single point in history, which is people withdrawing their labour, people refusing to pay for things, people occupying things and not going away from places that they're not meant to be in, and people looking after each other, mutual aid and solidarity. And I think especially as things get worse, as they're going to over the next few months, the next stage in being able to articulate all these demands together in order to have a red-green front, to put forward the kind of politics that Chantal's talking about and writing about, is to bring those together in concrete ways, to work together in campaigns, which, you know, encouragingly is happening. And you know, I think, for example, what you write about the environmental movement, I think it was 100% true, or maybe 98% true, 5 years ago, as in too liberal in framework, eschewing antagonism and so on. But I've been really encouraged now working with the more radical end of the climate movement now, who previously were talking about being beyond politics, who now place the struggle for the end of the month alongside the struggle to prevent the end of the world as part of their framework.
Yeah, I agree with you. And here it's interesting to see the difference between an optic center on Britain and mine, which is center on Europe. Because in fact, it's quite paradoxical. But at the moment, I read, of course, a lot of foreign newspaper, and what they say about Britain is quite interesting, because on one side there is the whole saga between, you know, Johnson, is something that really you know, is very difficult for the, you know, continental people to understand. But they are also, in a sense, also a mess. Even if I think they don't really capture yet the importance of that, the fact that there is suddenly a lot of strike and movement in Britain, because, you know, they had been accustomed to the period of Thatcherism in which nothing was happening here, and then suddenly what's happening? Why is it that, you know, the all those strikes? I mean, they are completely flabbergasted by that. I think that. And of course, it's very different with respect to, and I think in a sense what I was saying about the possibility for neoliberalism to reassert, is more true for you know, the continental Europe. Because, for instance, take the case of France, for instance, the way in which the Gilets jaunes were crushed completely. So there was the moment in which I wrote for left populism, there was a lot of movement, but they were crushed. And also something, at that time, we were all absolutely convinced that Macron would never be re-elected. You know, it was, and then suddenly, yes, he was re-elected. And I think that is a consequence of the pandemic. And the need for protection, for stability. So a lot of people who were more militant, so it was really a moment that stopped. Many movements, many form of the demand of resistance were crushed. And of course, I'm not saying that they disappear and they are again beginning to fall, but there was a big moment of setback. That was meant a real setback in most of continental Europe. And I think I don't really see the same thing for here in Britain. Well, except that, I mean, of course, we could really ask in what sense, for instance, the election of Johnson, or the first Johnson, because and then Sunak end up. So they are in fact contradictory movement here in Britain. On one side, you've got all this resilience of neoliberalism under form which are each time worse and more authoritarian. But on the other side, you've got also the emergence of a series of movement, which are in fact not I don't know how to say that exactly. But we're not accustomed to that precisely because of the way in which trade union and business crush. And so let me put it that, despite of many things, I see one could be more hopeful about the situation in Britain. You know, despite you've got, of course, one of the worst possible government, but on the other side, there are reason to be hopeful that things can't go on like that, and they might change. Yeah, so that's true. In things are more ambivalent in Western Europe, because in Western Europe, what we are, Western Europe, I never know how to speak of Europe, know that Britain is not anymore, but continental Europe is probably the way in which you will. And then I think if let's make a little bit of political fiction. You know, if we can imagine where the important resistance movement are going to develop, I will think probably in Britain. You know, more than, because in Western Europe is this where we've been seeing the development of right wing populist movement. You know, and the victory, was not complete victory, except that in Italy, yes, it was a complete victory, but the rise, the increasing success of right-wing populist movement. I mean, that is something which is really specific of Western Europe. You know, Spain, France, Italy. The situation in Britain is different from that point of view. Huh? But of course, if we look at the government, we say no. But I think it will be important to see what are the resistances which are being developed here. So, yeah, I think. But I still believe, even if I don't see much of, signals of something like that in Britain at the moment. We just can't take it for granted that the next election, the Labour Party is going to win. And of course, what that would mean is not very particularly enthusiastic. But of course,
longer prison terms for protesters.
Yeah. It would be very good to get rid of the Tories in any case, even if it's something which is not particularly the kind of government that they would like. But I think that, let me put the point in that way. I think that we are today, it's true, I'm more thinking in terms of continental Europe. We are at a crossroad because one possibility is development of really much more authoritarian government, and this is the success of this authoritarian neoliberalism. I think that's, and of course, the way to fight against that, and this is why I insist very much on the importance for the left of understanding, you know, the importance of affect, and to say the question is that this feeling of protection, need for protection, which is really a consequence of you know, the pandemic and now the geopolitical situation, is something that can be exploited in two different ways. It can be exploited by the right, and of course, it is already being exploited by the right to develop some kind of what I'm called neo-authoritarian neoliberalism, but it can also be exploited by the left, you know, in order, but at condition of taking account of this demand for protection and trying to imagine how it can be articulated into a progressive direction. And I, at the moment, I think that the offensive of the right towards authoritarianism is stronger than the reaction of the left. You know, and here I come to my question. It's basically a question of not understanding or dismissing, you know, from the part of the left, the importance of affect, because the left is much too rationalistic. You know, the left is convinced that it's by argument that you are going to, I'm not against argument, but it's by argument alone that you are going to bring people to act in the way that you want to you would like to see. And for instance, and of course, you know, as a political philosopher, I'm always interested in what people have said in that sense. I think, for instance, and I insist on that in the book, there is a lesson from Spinoza that is very important for the left to understand. Is that Spinoza say, for instance, I mean, two things which I think are particularly important. He said that ideas have force only when they meet affects. You know, I think I see too much on the side of the left, and particularly of certain kind of you know, British left, the idea that what we need is a good program. You know, if we have a good program, people automatically will accept it and will follow it. I don't believe that at all. You know, I think that of course a good program is important, but it needs to be articulated with affects. And in the book, I refer to my interpretation of the election 2019. You know, and I say on one side, you will get Boris Johnson, no program at all, but just a few very powerful slogans. You know, get Brexit done, take back control. And on the other side, you had the Labour Party, and I acknowledge, we discussed that before, James, the beginning of the campaign of Corbyn was perfect. I thought, you know, I was really very impressed by the first presentation. It was some kind of Roosevelt. They hate me, but I welcome their... there was really a construction of a frontier, you know? But of course, after this, apparently, you know, you know very much better than me why this happened. There was a shift in the direction of the campaign, and then what we had is a list of very good policies. You know, a lot of free broadband and that and that and that, but sold to people in some kind of what I will call a clientelistic way. You know, so it was, vote for us and we will give you that. Vote for us and we will give you that. So, but there was absolutely no mobilization of people. Because you need, one thing is to have good policies, but another thing is to make people desire those policies. You know, they are not going simply, well, very good. No, this is where I think that the missing link in for many people when think of politics. Good program, yes, but also the need to make people feel that this is. And for instance, in that election, we must acknowledge that people felt empowered by saying, bring back control. It was moved. And on the other side, no, follow us and we'll give you some kind of what I call precisely characteristic, you know. So I think that, and of course it was absolutely no surprise that Johnson got such a good result, you know. I'm not saying, of course, here that what the Labour Party should have been doing was to compete with Johnson in terms of those kind of, you know, slogans, but to realize that it needed to, as Spinoza say, ideas that they bother need to meet affects. So you need to have, and that also means something which for me is important here. It's important to have things that resonate with the people and to really ask, you know, to try to understand what they want. I mean, you in your book, if I remember well, you say the problem with the question of free broadband, it was a very good policy, but nobody was asking for that, you know? So instead of, and there is what I call the rationality of the left, is that we know best, you know? We know what people should want. So, you know, and so we are going to give them what they need. Well, no, fortunately, it doesn't work like that. You know, you also try to need to understand what people really desire, and of course, you know, to those desire, you must answer them. They can be answered in different ways. You know, not it's not to say, oh, what people ask for that. No, but to say what are they really demanding. But that, of course, then, and you are going to frame that in a way, it can be framed in a way which is really, you know, progressive in a sense of conservative, or it may also be framed in a way in which it's going to further democracy. So for me, that's something extremely important, you know. And this, in fact, and I think we should, this is a point that we should also address, the question of what should be the policy today in front of the climate emergency. And we've got a little differences because you advocate a Green New Deal and advocate a Green Democratic Revolution. Well, here I want to insist that when I'm speaking of a Green Democratic Revolution, I'm not at all saying something that goes against the Green New Deal. You know, I think that, and in fact, I'll defend that. If we are thinking of what should be the strategy today, it's the Green New Deal is in terms of policies. But you see, this is where the question is. The policy is the best set of policies. But my argument is that policies are not enough. You can have the best policies, but you need to make, as I was saying before, design those policies. And this is why my proposal in the book is to say, to envisage those policies, this Green New Deal, yes, it should be envisaged, presented in terms of a Green Democratic Revolution, to insist on the fact that to put in practice those different policies, that is going to open a future. I mean, here I refer often to a myth in the sense of Sorel. That is a view of the future that really gives a new sense to the present. You know, which is, and this is a set of policies. The Green New Deal does not give this supplement of soul, if you want. You need to endow it with an affective force. So in fact, what I'm proposing by speaking of a Green Democratic Revolution is to endow those policies with an affective dimension, because I'm really convinced that in our societies, the idea of democracy is a very important signifier. And that, you know, it is something that mobilizes people. And the idea of a Green Democratic Revolution, that those policies are, in fact, there will be a rupture. It's a form of revolution, but a democratic one. You know, because here, I think, this is a point we have not referred to when we were speaking of the challenge today and the conjuncture in general, we are also at the moment, and here I might be a little less optimistic than you, because I think that this climate emergency and the of course, I agree. I mean, they are not going to be able to propose a solution that is really going to go against the I mean, the crisis of accumulation is something there to stay. But it's not necessarily going to produce a crisis, because it is important to as I was saying, motivate people, make them see things, design things in those measures that we are proposing need to. I'm not finding my English at the moment is particularly bad, but and I find difficulties in countering the words. But I think that it's one of the dangers, as I see it, is the possible success of a green capitalism. I think that, you know, for instance, a few years ago, climate deniers were very important. Today, I think that there are not so many climate deniers. Well, at least in Europe. What I see and what I've noticed very much, particularly in the discussion that are taking place in Europe, the right and everybody more accept that something really need to change, but. Some people are saying, well, the solution is green capitalism. So let me put it in this way. I don't think that the dividing line today is between climate deniers and people who say, no, we've got to do something. You know, is people accept that we've got to do something. But the question is, that what are we going to do? And some people say, well, a question of green capitalism. This is the solution. Geoengineering and things like that. That's the solution. You know, so and of course, what we are both proposing is the fact the ecological bifurcation, you know, which implies a rupture, and clearly, I think a rupture with financial capitalism. You know, this for me, this is something which is must be absolutely central in the way to address, you know, the climate emergency, to accept the need for a rupture with financial capitalism. And this is where I'm not quite sure, as we are saying, it's true that the movement, the climate movement has been radicalized. For instance, if you think of the first interviews or intervention of Greta Thunberg, I mean, this woman has been extremely radicalized. Yeah. Extremely radicalized, you know. So that's a good sign but for instance, I still see a lot of ecological movement. Look, ecological movement, for instance, in Germany, make alliance with the right. So it means that many ecological movement is not accepted the idea that we need a rupture with financial capitalism. You know, they still believe that it's possible. And I think that this is, again, why I think that a left populist strategy is important in the present circumstances, you know, because left populist strategy insists the need to establish a frontier, determine an adversary, and the other fact that to create a vast movement in which the affective dimension is going to be important, you know, because this is, I think, central.
Hello, listeners. The London Review of Books has just launched a new subscription podcast called Close Readings. For just $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you can access all our Close Readings series. This year, we have ones on classical literature with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones, medieval literature with Irina Dumitrescu and Mary Wellesley, and 19th and 20th century literature with Mark Ford and Seamus Perry. Each series has 12 episodes, so you'll receive a new episode from each one every month, and you can listen in most podcast apps. To sign up, go to lrb.me/close readings or click on the link in the description.
Perfect time, I think, to see what affects we have spurred in the audience and what questions they will desire. So there's a roving mic if anyone's got any questions.
Just maybe two questions before we... Okay, one, two, three, four.
Well, thank you, Chantal and James. Yeah, I only had the chance of reading Chantal's book, which was very... I felt very enlightened, even though you're very critical of the Lightning Project, but I think it really brings up very fundamental questions that the left wasn't making in the last decades. And one of my questions that I would like to make is regarding the role of affects in politics and in the conception around the political. We know, I come from Chile, for example, and we've seen that in the last referendum that we had when we wanted to approve the most, one of the most progressive and leftist constitutions in the world, we realized that we lost the election for different reasons, but one of the hypotheses around it is that the whole campaign was led by a very important advertising creative director, which in some kind of suggests that the...
Sorry, you are referring to the previous referendum, not this one.
No, the last one.
The last one, yes.
Yeah, it was the same creative director that also led the last Bachelet's campaign when she got elected.
Yes.
And it makes me think also like how the case of Cambridge Analytica was very influential at the time of mobilizing affects and emotions of the voters in favor of Brexit. So in some way, yeah, we know that affects play a fundamental role in politics and in articulating political projects nowadays. The right wing is more aware of it than we are. But the thing is that there's an ethical problem behind, right? Because the right wing in some way instrumentalizes emotions. They manipulate the emotions of the voters from lies, from fake news. And in that way, I wonder, okay, how we as the left can make use of affects, can tap into emotions without falling in unethical issues and issues of ethics, and at the same time without falling in a creative war. Because, yeah, we can win elections in the future. We're winning elections now in Latin America, for example. But in the future, they're going to get better creative directors that would tap into affects in a more effective way. And in some ways, like, okay, we have the capacity of winning elections from affects, but how we actually articulate a collective political project that goes beyond saying yes or no, but constructing complex affects that say, okay, we are going to defend this pride of society against the neoliberal backlash in the future.
No, I agree with you that we have it. It's much more difficult for the left because precisely we need to, we can't use demagogic argument, but the question is that many people tend to believe that mobilizing affect is necessarily something demagogic, you know? And what my point is that is not true. And in fact, we can't leave that terrain to the right. And for too long, I think, and in too many places, the left is, we don't deal with that because this is necessarily, you know, in exactly the argument that you are making. But my argument is that there are many different ways in which one can mobilize affect. And also remember something that he insisted on is that I'm not saying here just mobilize affect. I'm not saying, for instance, that Corbyn should have an empty slogan in the same type of Johnson. But that is not enough to have the good arguments. You also need to find a way to speak to people, to mobilize people, they must resonate with them. So we've got a double job. So mobilize things, but not simply, you know, in a way in which they don't have content and no, that's it's much more difficult. And if you add to that the fact that most countries, I mean, if not all, the press is dominated by the right, you know, all the medium of communication are under the control of the right. And so people, what can we do? No, I think that, it's a hard struggle, but we just can't, if it will be completely self-defeating to say, we should not engage with that because that necessarily leads, no, But and my point is that we must be aware that it's a terrain in which the left is going to engage. And if we don't do it, look, why is it that, and that's a question I've been over, why is right-wing populism so much more successful than left populism, you know? And I think that is precisely because they know and they've got experience in doing that. We are, it's not a question of competing with them. I insist on that. It's a question of addressing also this question, not leaving the terrain to them, you know, and trying to see how we can. And I think that, well, this is why maybe I'm too optimistic about that, even if I'm not optimistic in general. The idea of a green democratic revolution is something that can resonate with the people. You know, it's the idea of democracy, the struggle for social justice, that it has been, for me, the driving force of what we call the left, you know? This is what motivated people to act. And I think that it's important to engage with that terrain. But I agree, it's not easy, and we've got an handicap with respect to the right, but it's not by, you know, leaving the terrain to them that we are double defeated, you know?
I just want to know, like, what, not in the UK especially, but in Europe, you have the rise of the far right now, and they're in power, and it's like, can you explain more into that, how do we fight that, how do we, you know, get together and be like, well, this is happening now, there, you know, what can we do and do stuff about it? That's it, thank you.
Well, here, there is something I want to say, and because before asking how to fight, we need to understand why people vote for those parties. You know, what is attractive for them? If we don't pose that question, and I think that's something I find very problematic about the left. They tend to dismiss those things. Ah, those people are, you know, fascist, homophobes, anti-feminist. In fact, I've seen that very much in the way in which in France, the left has been attacking Jean-Luc Mélenchon and La France Insoumise precisely because Mélenchon is one of those who is trying to put into practice this kind of left populist strategy that I was referring to. And for instance, he, in the last election, always went to speak with the people who vote for the Rassemblement National previously, National Front, you know, and try to understand, you know, what. And in fact, and I've got a friend of mine, François Ruffin, who has been elected the MP for Picardy, which is one of the area where these industrialized area, which was previously a left area, were a strong communists. There. And now they are all voting for the Marine Le Pen. So it's trying to say, and the people say, oh no, but those people, one should not even speak with people. Those people are homophobes. And François Ruffin, contrary, went to speak with people, and he was so much criticized for that. You know, for instance, the La France Insoumise was also very much criticized for having engaged with the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, you know, and trying to understand what they wanted. And no, with those people, we shouldn't even speak with people like that, you know. But François Ruffin was telling me, for instance, going to speak with those people, he began to understand a lot of things. For instance, one thing which I think for me is crucial is the responsibility of the left and the Socialist Party, particularly in France, for that, because they have kind of abandoned the terrain, you know. And that is very much linked to the fact that the crucial moment in which the left began to lose ground among those things, but when they really adopted neoliberalism, the idea that there was no alternative to neoliberal globalization. So all those people are precisely the people who have suffered so more from neoliberal globalization, you know, who are the loser of neoliberal globalization. And of course, the socialists did not have any discourse for those people, because they will to answer the demand of those people will have forced them to put into question neoliberal globalization. So they just abandon them, you know, they abandon them. And of course, no, they are surprised, you know, that why is it that they vote for Marine Le Pen? You know, because they are fascists there. No, and Ruffin was explaining to me, he spoke with people and tried to, you know, what is the motivate you and why are you... are you voting for? And he came to the conclusion, and because it was around for many people, were saying, for instance, that the only person who really came to speak with us and is Marine Le Pen. And Marine Le Pen, you know, said, what are you know their problems? And for instance. She was, yes, of course, you know, I do agree. But, you know, the problem are the immigrants. It's because of the immigrants that you are losing your job, that the social services are not so bad. So, you know, there was no alternative discourse to try to give another answer and say, well, yes, it's neoliberalism is a financial capitalism, which is at the origin of your trouble. You know, and that, I think, the problem is that the left is not taken enough seriously, the grievance of those people and trying to see how they could. And to finish my story about that, for instance, François was telling me, because he really took trouble to, by the way, he was elected in an area which nobody would imagine he would have elected because it was basically a stronghold of Marine Le Pen, you know. But he was saying, when discussing, he went to discuss with them and trying to say, and he said, through the discussion and trying to show them it was not the case like that. And he said, through the discussion, for instance, I saw them in their face, you know. He said, you might be right. And Tom said, I think you have a point here, you know. And he said, not all of them, of course, but several of them at the end of the you've convinced me. I'm going to vote for you. You know, I think, but you need to take the trouble to understand why is it, what motivates those people. If you've got if you are anti-immigrants, you know, why are you anti-immigrants? Why is it that to try to propose solutions that are going to? I think that is a complete mistake to believe that those people are lost for the left. But you need to try to understand, what the kind of ideology they've been given to by Marine Le Pen, and that to offer an alternative to that instead of moral condemnation, because I think that's the worst possible attitude. And in general, the attitude of the left with respect to those groups is moral condemnation. You know, and we don't even try, and it's not even worth trying to understand them. No, because it's pondering with the extreme right to do that. I think that for me is very important.
I'm sorry, I think we've just completely run out of time. I can see that there's lots of questions in the room, but please give your
can't
a warm,
you, I mean, thank we, you. Because, since we begin a bit later, can't we have another round of questions?
Everybody happy to. Okay. There was you, Johan, you still have a question?
Yeah, something to say, but I'll make it a question as well. I think Jeremy Corbyn's election to the leadership of the Labour Party in 2017 was a fluke, and it took the left by surprise as much as anybody else. I think a question to ask is, if he hadn't been elected, would that upswelling of affect of a whole generation of left-sympathising people that happened, would that have happened? Despite the fact that it did, and it carried huge momentum for 2 years, and momentum both in the sense of the organisation that you, James, helped found, and in the general sense of dynamism and energy. Nevertheless, it seems to me that the left fell back into the sectarianisms that that generation had given us a chance to transcend and escape from. And in and analysing the defeat of December 2019, my comrades in the Labour Party, almost to a person, blame the left. And I like to say that there's a truth in arguing that that we didn't lose that election. We were beaten. We were beaten by an enemy an establishment that was determined, that having been brought to within a whisker of socialism in government in Britain, was determined never to let that happen again. And there was, to a degree, a perfect storm, which Brexit helped. But, you know, the whipping up of myths of anti-Semitism and all the rest, a whole lot of things that conspired to ensure that the status quo remained. What I like about James's book, and I haven't finished it, but I think it's a breath of fresh air, and I can't speak about Chantal Mouffe because I haven't seen it yet, and I'm interested particularly in the context of Britain, is the way in which he seizes that sense of unsectarian leftism, that sense of effect that Chantal's been talking about, and put some detail on it. The idea of a bloc, the idea of a bloc that's kind of coordinated to a degree by a secretariat, and the detail that in the bit I've got to in the second part of the book, where there's a whole lot of specific suggestions of specific instances of bloc building and of shared momentum, I think that's really helpful. And it's optimistic, and it's actually offers a sense of dealing with the enemy, because the other thing, and I'd like to finish on this, is that I haven't heard very much at all from you about the enemy, the ruling parties, the establishment, and its determination to hang together. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't end up as the best part, the biggest party in the next election, because I think we need to hold on to how to deal with them in the terms that were made possible by 2017 and along the lines that James is outlining in his excellent book.
Well, no, I absolutely agree with you, totally. But and I think that maybe James could add a few things to, because you were speaking about, you were asking a few questions about, you know, what happened in the Labour Party, and I think maybe James could give us a few, why the defeat, or you could, yeah. Because not everybody here has read the book, so in fact you should. Allow them to know, and maybe even go if you've been having since then, because in fact the book was finished by March, wasn't it? Probably, yeah. So, and I think it will be interesting for you to tell, you know, how you see the evolution there, but and address some of the questions that were posed here with respect to what went wrong in the Labour Party. But I must say that I totally agree with you about the importance of James' book, absolutely. But again, I mean, I don't have much to say about politics in Britain. He knows much more than that, and he's been involved into it, you know. So I think that he's the one to speak about this issue.
So, I promise I didn't plan to ask that question. Thanks very much. So if Jeremy hadn't been elected leader of the party in 2015, obviously things would have been different. I think what was going on at the time was there was a search for some kind of outlet for anti-austerity sentiment. And I think if it hadn't found its place there, it would have found it in a different formation. There are a whole load of different movements that were springing up. So we would have had something, but it wouldn't have been, I don't think it would have been as mass. I don't think it would have been as normal. I don't think it would have cohered in such a way and would have advanced us so far. And I think, you're right. The thing that I'm trying to do is to show how the various forces that were brought together, either because they were already previously organised or because they were newly brought into politics, people that were newly brought in the Corbyn project, can find a new formation. You know, we had one formation, that was what happens when we have the leadership of the party, and, you know, most things are trained on that because we've got a very clear strategic horizon. Now, you know, we have to come to find a different formation. And I think, you know, one big thing that has happened in the last 2 years is that progressive opinion, socialist opinion, left opinion, has been chased out of the public sphere. You heard people say left-wing things on TV and radio to some extent for a four-year period, and then that's been shut away. I think the only time when that can come out is when movements and activists do real world things. So we had 48 hours of Mick Lynch dominating the airwaves and speaking total common sense, and the overwhelming majority of people who listened to him think, oh, this guy's great, who's he? That's because a real world thing was happening. As in, they were on strike, there was a real struggle which had to be reported so he could claim airtime. And I think that's, you know, we need to keep on thinking in the majoritarian ways that we were thinking, or when we were at our best, when Jeremy was the leader, we were thinking of. But now trying to hold together these different things, exactly as you're saying, in a non-sectarian way. And on the evolution, where it goes, without totally spoiling the ending, the last chapter is four possible futures, four little histories of the 2030s written from the... Oh, sorry, of the 2020s, written from the perspective of 2030, where the same strategy is pursued, but the point is there's contingency. You know, what I certainly wouldn't be sitting here talking to if a man called Eric Joyce, who was a Labour MP, didn't punch a Tory MP because he was drunk in a bar in Parliament in 2013. So, you know, the contingency really matters. And that's my point about the Labour Party, yes or no. We can't know. We can't know exactly how the future is going to unfold. What we can do is strengthen our forces where we are, try to knit them together, try to get beyond traditional left sectarianism. And I think that's the best way we can build a kind of mass movement and movement, and that will get political expression in the same way that there was this, amorphous force that was seeking a way in to find political expression prior to 2015. For example, 50,000 people joined the Green Party in the weeks before the 2015 election. That's part of that same set of phenomena. Then, because things are the way they are, they won't stay the way they are, and that will get some, you know, that will get some political expression, and we'll go again. But it'll be a different formation. It won't look the same, but we should learn the lessons from before.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.